And we've been talking with Jeffrey Bennett about his latest work, What is Relativity? And we're going to talk with him about one of his earlier books, Beyond UFOs, The Search for Extraterrestrial Life and Its Astonishing Implications to Our Future. Welcome back, Jeffrey Bennett with us. Jeffrey, of course, when you wrote Beyond UFOs, everybody went crazy thinking it was just about UFOs. It's about science. It's about life out there and the incredible possibilities that there's intelligent life out there.
That's right. That was my goal, was to not just talk about UFOs, but to talk about all the real science that's actually looking for the same kinds of things.
When you started looking at the possibility of extraterrestrial life, did you do it based on, you know, the Drake equation, that they've got to have enough planets out there and some of those have to have intelligent life?
Well, I think that, you know, from a scientific standpoint, what you want to do is first start and say, well, are there places where there could be life? Are there other stars that would be suitable? Yes. Are there planets that would be suitable? 15 years ago, we didn't know, but now we know, yes, they're very, very common, thanks to recently announced results from Kepler. And then you can start to go back to that Drake equation that's been around for a while and say, wow, we now know that the number of possible places for life is just unbelievably large. How could there not be? And so then you start to look at the question of how are we going to go about actually searching for it.
When you look at all the different planetary systems that they're beginning to find throughout the entire universe, you've got to make that assumption that there are others out there, more advanced.
I like to think about the number of worlds with a little counting exercise. So thanks to the Kepler mission, we now can say with great confidence that at least 20% of all stars have an Earth-sized planet orbiting them. And quite likely, as we get more data, that number will shoot up from 20% to perhaps 90% or more. I would not be at all surprised. Which means that there must be about as many Earth-like planets as there are stars out there in the universe. And so in our Milky Way galaxy alone, there are more than 100 billion stars. So we can now say there's also more than 100 billion Earth-like planets out there, or at least Earth-sized planets out there. And then you can say, well, what is 100 billion? So if you started counting, you know, maybe after listeners are done with the show tonight, when they're trying to fall asleep, they start counting stars, 1, 2, 3, 4.
You'll be counting forever.
Well, when will you get to 100 billion? And, of course, it depends on how fast you count. But if you count 1 per second, which incidentally sounds easy when you say 1, 2, 3, mm-hmm. 4, but it's not so easy to say it in 1 per second when you get to 58,396,444,352, because you also have to say it that quick and remember what comes next. But if you could do it, if you could count it 1 per second, it would take you 100 billion seconds to count these planets in our galaxy. And 100 billion seconds, if you get out your calculator and divide by 60 seconds per minute and 60 minutes per hour and 24 hours per day and 365 days per year, you'll find that 100 billion seconds is more than 3,000 years. So it would take you more than 3,000 years just to count the Earth-sized planets in our galaxy, let alone to actually find them all, studying them all, see which ones have life, see which ones have had intelligent life at some point. And that's just our Milky Way galaxy. When you go beyond that to the other galaxies, you find that throughout our observable universe, there are more stars, which means probably more planets the size of Earth, than there are grains of sand on all the beaches in the world. So yes, if you then say, could we be the only sand grain with life? It seems rather far-fetched to imagine that that's the case. Now, scientifically, we can't answer that question yet, but it certainly seems far-fetched to imagine we're the only ones.
Well, you know, Jeffrey, we're 4.5 billion years old. The universe, let's say, is 13.5. That means that there were 9 billion years a head start for a lot of different solar systems and other planetary systems.
That's right. And one of the things I like to remind people of is that because there has been that 9 billion year head start for the rest of the universe to have in principle, it means, and if you define civilization, you know, you can define civilization in different ways, intelligent civilization, but for the purposes of wanting to make contact with aliens, a civilization is someone who's capable of at least radio transmissions through the universe.
That's
and
right.
Hopefully we're even there. Space travel. And that means we're a very young civilization. We've only been capable of these things in a rudimentary way for a few decades. And what that means when you look at all the time there's been is that if the universe really is full of civilizations, if the Milky Way galaxy is full of civilizations, as seems very reasonable to imagine, we're almost certainly the most technologically backward one because all the rest of them had a big head start on us.
So the big question is if they were ahead of us, how long do civilizations last before they either kill themselves off or something happens?
That is the big question, because we know that based on everything we've done as a species throughout our history, if we survive, it seems a virtual certainty that we would eventually start traveling to the stars and start to colonize the galaxy. And that means someone who has a head start on us should have gotten around to that already. And so if that's true, then there is already a galactic civilization out there. And I know, of course, that many of your listeners will agree that that's the likely case because they think we've seen UFOs. In science, we don't discount that possibility. There may well be UFOs visiting us. We just haven't scientifically seen strong enough evidence for all of us to be convinced. But certainly, it seems very reasonable that that is the case, that there's a galactic civilization. If there's not a galactic civilization, then you'd have to ask, well, why not? And the most likely answer would be that no one colonizes the galaxy because they kill themselves off before they get that advanced with their technology. And when you look at our current world situation, it's quite easy to believe that this happens to civilizations, because whenever you develop the technology to build radio telescopes and build spacecraft, you're automatically going to also have the technology to build nuclear bombs, to cause global warming, and to do other things that could in principle be detrimental to your civilization. And the question is, which one is going to win out? Are you going to be smart enough to use your technology for the good things, or are you going to succumb to the bad ones?
Well, and that's the $64,000 question, isn't it?
Or $64 trillion question.
Yeah,
yep.
Exactly. You know, throughout the history of mankind, I'm convinced that the primordial soup is the same. Are there, in your opinion, elements that we've never discovered that could be out there on other planets?
We can actually detect elements throughout the universe from their spectral signatures, what we call spectroscopy. And we know that throughout the observable universe, it's the same set of elements that you learned about in chemistry class on the periodic table. And in fact, in the same abundances, the universe is made about 75% chemically of hydrogen and almost 25% of helium, and then there's only a tiny leftover bit, you know, less than 2%, that's other elements. But among those other elements, the most common ones are carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, the very ones that form the basis of life on Earth. So for that reason, it seems very natural to assume that you would get life with a similar chemistry on other worlds. Now, of course, it's possible that you could get a different chemistry using different elements. Silicon has been a favorite of science fiction writers to use instead of carbon, and that may be the case. But one way or other, it seems to our current knowledge that you're probably going to have a similar starting point in that primordial soup that you talk about when a world is young. Now, once life gets started, evolution is going to create a great diversity of creatures, and those we would not expect to be the same from one world to another, just like at different times in Earth's history, they've been different. And in different ecosystems, you find different species that are adapted to that particular environment.
Would you be disappointed? Would you be shocked if there was no intelligent life out there?
I would be shocked. Absolutely, yes. Even though scientifically we have not established evidence for any life beyond Earth, I think we're going to find it soon. I think we're going to find evidence of primitive life on Mars. I will not be at all surprised if that happens. In fact, I'd be surprised if it didn't happen.
And what's your definition of primitive life?
Something that's probably microscopic. And that's because on Mars, the only place you find water, and we think you probably need water or at least some form of liquid to have life, because you have to have a way to transport energy into a living cell and waste products out, so you need a liquid of some sort. Water is the liquid on Earth that life uses. And on Mars, there's also liquid water, but only underground. Mm-hmm. On the surface, it's all frozen as ice. And so since we're talking about underground life on Mars and little pores in the rocks where you'd find water, it could only be microscopic. There's no place for bigger stuff to live. There's other places in our solar system, though, where there could, in principle, be larger living things. The oceans of Europa, which are liquid water oceans, and Europa is a moon orbiting Jupiter. Or for those of your listeners who watched the second episode of Cosmos with Neil deGrasse Tyson this week.
Yeah. He's doing a great job, isn't he?
He's doing a wonderful job. I love the show. And he showed an imaginary voyage to Titan, which is a moon of Saturn, where the liquid is not water, but methane and ethane, essentially liquid natural gas. And it's possible that that could support life instead of water. And since you have huge lakes on Titan, you could, in principle, have big life there. But for intelligent life, we need to look out to planets around other stars as their home worlds. And again, the numbers are so incredible. As many stars that would take you 3,000 years to count just in our galaxy alone, and as many as there are grains of sand on all the beaches of the world for the whole universe, yes, I'd be completely shocked if it turned out we were alone.
And again, the theory, if we're being visited, what are they doing with us? What might be happening? Were we seeded by them? All possibilities, I think.
That's right. That's right. And if there is a galactic civilization, which those folks who've read my book, or if they do, I hope that others will know that I think that's the most likely possibility, that there is a galactic civilization out there already. And if there is, then there's certainly a very good chance that they are visiting us right now.
How many galaxies do you think might be in the universe?
Well, we can count by looking at telescopic images, and there are something like 100 billion galaxies in the universe. So again, you know, just as it takes that 3,000 years to count the stars or planets in our galaxy, it would also take that 3,000 years to count the galaxies. And that's why when you put those two things together, you end up with as many stars and planets as there are grains of sand.
Truly astronomical.
Truly. And based on, as we talked about in the first hour, this new discovery about inflation, we can also be quite confident that our observable universe is only a small piece of everything there is, even though we can't see the other stuff.
Jeffrey, what fuels our intelligence? It keeps getting, you know, faster, better, smarter. New ideas keep coming. Look where we've gone in the last 100 years. What fuels that advance?
Well, you know, that's actually a really interesting question, because in terms of our actual, what you might call our raw intelligence, our brain power, we're really no different than we were many, many thousands of years ago, probably 20,000 years ago. If you went back to caveman times and with a time machine and grabbed a baby and brought them here, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference as they grew up between them and anybody else. And in terms of actual brain power, we've not evolved in 20,000 years. Evolution takes longer than that. So the fuel for our great acceleration in our technology has really been the ability to build upon previous generations. So for, you know, if you go back further, for the first, you know, million years ago, there were people they were maybe not quite as intelligent as us, but they were pretty intelligent, but they didn't have a way to pass their knowledge on other than through storytelling from one generation to the next, and things moved very, very slowly. In fact, language was still developing. The real dramatic changes that happened began first with writing, so that you could actually record things so that the next generation could see what the previous generation had learned. The printing press in the 1500s caused a dramatic acceleration of technology, because now, instead of only one person being able to read a book that someone had transcribed at a time, now you could print off millions of copies, and lots of people could read the same book and get the same thing. And now, of course, with computers and the internet, we have an even greater ability to share information among all of us, and that makes it possible for everyone to learn more, and therefore to learn faster, and therefore to make new discoveries faster.
Does there come a point, though, where we've saturated discoveries?
That's a really good question. There are people who think we're getting close to that point, and there's others who say it will never, ever come. My own guess is that probably not. I think there's so much out there to learn that I think at least for the foreseeable future, things will keep moving at a very fast pace.
If there is intelligent life out there, do you think that there are incredible similarities to us in that they will have eyes, a mouth, a nose, ears? I think they would.
Yeah, it's, you know, if you're going to be, certainly there's variations on intelligence and body shape even on Earth, right? Dolphins look a lot different than us, even though they're pretty smart. Not as smart as us, but they're pretty darn smart,
well,
right?
They may be smarter than us. Dolphins will never
build spacecraft because they don't have hands.
They don't have hands. They don't have that thumb.
And a being that didn't have eyes wouldn't know there was any place to go.
That's right.
So in some sense, almost kind of by definition, if you're looking for intelligent beings who could communicate across space or travel through space, they have to have some of the same physiological capabilities that we do. They wouldn't necessarily have to have them looking exactly the same way. I mean, you know, an octopus shape would certainly work fine for building stuff and seeing things. Or you might be able to imagine all sorts of other body shapes that someone might have. But they'd have to have the same body capabilities.
I think so, too. What fascinates you the most of your work, what you do?
I think, you know, the most fascinating thing to me really is this question of, are we alone? And everything that I work on, whether it's just the general astronomy and helping students understand the universe through my textbooks, or what is relativity that we were talking about the first hour in my book, trying to help people understand that, all of it ties back in to this question of, are we alone in the universe? Relativity, for example, if you do want to travel among the stars, you're either limited to traveling no faster than light, or you have to use those loopholes that relativity might allow, like hyperspace, wormholes, warp drive. And so either way, if you want to think about the possibility of aliens traveling through space, you have to know something about relativity. So all my work focuses in a way around that question. And then I think even deeper than that is the question that you brought up earlier, which is, can we survive? And I think we are now at what I like to think of as the turning point in history. If you go back through any generation before ours, you know, they could have done terrible things to each other and to the Earth. They did do terrible things to each other and to the Earth, but they never had the capability to wipe out all of us. We now have that capability. At the same time, they also never had the capability to start to expand into space, and we now have that capability. This generation alive today is the turning point of human history. This generation will determine whether our descendants are gone because we've wiped out the possibility of their existence, or whether our descendants are heading out to the stars. It all depends on what happens in the next perhaps few decades, certainly I would say the next century.
It is amazing. It's a great time to be alive, isn't it, Jeffrey?
It is a great time to be alive. It's also a great burden for this generation, especially for kids of today. You know, they're really the ones growing up today. This is why I write my children's books also, is they're the ones growing up who have to make sense of this world and make that decision on which way we'll go.
We're going to talk more about science with Jeffrey Bennett when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we will take your phone calls with Jeffrey Bennett as we talk about what is relativity and also his work beyond UFOs. That'll be all next hour when we come back. I've got a few more questions to go before we get into calls. And welcome back to Coast, Jeffrey Bennett with us. Jeffrey, I'm going to wow you with my one Albert Einstein story. You ready for it?
Yep.
I give this at events and stuff like that. They kind of like it. He used to give speeches all around the country, and he had a driver who looked like him. And there was one day he was just exhausted. He had given as many speeches as he was going to give that week. He was done. So he told his driver, he says, look, let's switch clothes. You wear my clothes. I'll wear your driver's outfit. You give the speech today. I'm exhausted. I'm not going to do it. And the driver says, oh, Mr. Einstein, I'm not going to do that. He says, I insist. So they did. They switched clothes, and they go into this venue, and the driver, who looks like Albert Einstein, is on stage, and he's talking to people and doing the best he can. Meanwhile, Einstein is, you know, has done his thing. And so when he's done, somebody in the crowd says, and Mr. Einstein, can you tell me the basis of your theory, E equals MC squared? How did you come up with that? And he looks around and goes, I don't have that answer, but my valet can answer it for you. That's my story.
Awesome.
What does quantum mechanics mean?
Quantum mechanics is a little bit of an odd term. The quantum mechanics is our theory of very, very small things, of atoms and subatomic particles. And the name quantum comes from the idea that if you realize the etymology, quantum means like counting. And so what we've discovered, what was discovered in the early 1900s, was that if you look at energy levels or other aspects of subatomic particles, they can't be anything. They can only have certain values. It's sort of like if you go up an elevator, you can be at any height, but if you go up a ladder, you can only be at the heights of the particular steps. And those steps are the analogy to quanta, to the levels that are allowed. So quantum mechanics gets its name because it comes from this idea that there's only certain allowed energy levels for particles.
People in your field, the field science, I mean, are there disagreements or do you agree on most things?
Well, the way science works is something becomes a theory when the evidence is so overwhelming that you really can't disagree with it if you pay any attention to what's going on. And so there's no disagreements about what works and what's there. So everybody agrees quantum mechanics works. Everybody agrees that general relativity works. The disagreements come from, does that cover everything, or are there other questions that we have not yet addressed with those theories? And in fact, we know there's other questions that we've not yet addressed. And what might be the things that fill in those unanswered questions? And the other disagreements come in the philosophical implications of these things. Last hour, we talked a bit about relativity and whether it implies that your future is already etched in space-time in some sense, or whether you're etching it as you go. And that's a philosophical question that will generate lots of disagreement.
Let's talk a little bit about what movies and TV does to the world of science. Do they portray it in a pretty accurate way?
Well, you know, it depends on exactly what you mean by accurate. A lot of movies just go, you know, completely into the fantasy realm. Some try to stay fairly accurate. And, you know, depending on how accurate you're looking for, you'll get different levels. You know, if you look at, say, Star Wars and Star Trek, for the most part, they avoid scientific problems by inventing these means, hyperspace and warp drive, that don't conflict with relativity and yet still allow you to get around the universe quickly. To me, the parts that are probably least scientifically accurate in those shows are where all the different aliens are at about the same technological level as us, because as we talked about earlier, you would expect that they had a big head start on us, or else they're not at the point of being a technology yet. So we wouldn't expect to run into other aliens with the same technology as us. They'd be way ahead or still coming up and way behind, not yet capable of travel. Then there's movies like Gravity, which I love.
I loved it too. Great effects.
And it did a really good job of portraying what it would feel like to be weightless out there in space. Now, if you want to be nitpicky, there's plenty of places where there's scientific inaccuracies. But in a big picture sense, I think it did a very good job of giving a big picture view of what things are like.
How about Contact?
I love Contact. And Contact, again, is using a scientific idea, wormholes, that we don't know that you can actually travel through them the way that Carl Sagan imagined there. But we also can't say that you can't. And therefore, it's a good device for science fiction. And in terms of how we might react to a confirmed contact with aliens, I thought it was a very interesting way to portray it. And I love the movie, and I actually love the book even more.
There are some that believe that traveling through wormholes will put you into other multiverses.
Correct. Once a wormhole, in a sense, is taking you through a hole in the universe, right? And once you pop out of our universe, if there is a multiverse, there's really no guarantee you're going to pop back into this one, right? If you think about it in those terms. But what actually happens in there, we really can't say well. You can mathematically map out what wormholes might do, but one of the things that comes up in general relativity is that wormholes, the moment you enter one, it collapses. And that's why we have difficulty envisioning how you could travel through them. You would have to have some way that we don't know today to keep it stable.
Why would it collapse the minute you enter it?
I can't give you the details on that, but it just has to do with the way the equations work, that when you add another element into it, it causes the wormhole in space-time to collapse.
And the element would be us, let's say.
The element would be anything, any kind of mass going into it. So, yes, wormholes come out of the mathematics of general relativity, but they also, at least from our current understanding, it would seem like you can't travel through them. But that's where you can imagine possible ways that there might be to get around that if there's new physics that we haven't discovered yet.
E equals MC squared. That yep. famous equation, part of my joke. Why is it so important to what scientists like you talk about, research?
It is important not just to science, but to everything. E is energy, M is mass, and C stands for the speed of light. So E equals MC squared is telling us that a small amount of mass, you multiply that by the speed of light squared, which is a huge number, can give you an enormous amount of energy. And where does this equation come from? You know, Einstein didn't just go on the board and write E equals MC squared. It comes out of his special theory of relativity, what we've been talking about with space-time, when he worked out the equations of space-time. And in fact, this is actually very simple mathematics. It can be done with eighth grade algebra. And when you do that, you find that once you realize space and time are intertwined, mass and energy are also intertwined. And you get this equation, E equals MC squared. So he published it in 1905 as part of his special theory of relativity. So it is integral to that. In a sense, every time you test E equals MC squared, you're testing the theory of relativity and confirming that it is correct. And what does E equal MC squared have to do with? Well, that's how the sun produces its energy. So every time you're outside on a sunny day, you're getting yourself proof that E equals MC squared is true from the sunlight hitting you. It also tells us how electronics work because it's built into the theory of electromagnetism, which relativity encompasses. And so every time you turn on the radio, everybody listening out there tonight is actually testing E equals MC squared right now. So it is involved in everything that we do.
It helped create the atomic bomb, didn't it?
And so mass into energy is how the sun shines, and it's also how nuclear bombs work, and it's also how nuclear reactors work. So, yes, it is integral to all of those things.
How can something so minute, a little piece of uranium, create so much energy?
Well, from the equation standpoint, that's what the C squared is. So C is the speed of light, and as you know, the speed of light is very, very fast. So it's a big number, the speed of light. You square it, and you got a really, really big number. So a small amount of mass can give you an enormous amount of energy. I like to talk about fusion, because that's the way thermonuclear bombs work. We don't know how to build nuclear fusion reactors for energy, but that's how the sun produces its energy.
Boy, if we could, though.
If we could. If you could hook up a nuclear fusion reactor to your kitchen sink and take the hydrogen out of the water that's flowing out of your sink if you leave the water running and fuse it to produce energy, to turn it into helium, and some of that mass is converted into energy, the water flowing through your kitchen sink, if you just kept grabbing the hydrogen out of it continuously, would produce enough fusion energy to power the entire United States. We would not need any other oil, coal, gas, nuclear, solar, anything. We could power the entire United States off of your kitchen sink if we could do nuclear fusion.
Will we ever get there?
Well, there was a breakthrough announced just this past week. It was in the front page of the Science Times and the New York Times today. So we're working on it. The question is, fusion is the joke among physicists has been it's a couple decades away and always has been and always will be, because we keep saying that we're a couple decades away, but new problems come up as we try to create it. But we know it's possible. We make bombs that way. The sun does it that way. So in my mind, since we know it's possible, it's only a matter of how much effort we're willing to put into it until we can create it. And to me, the very sad thing is we really spend, compared to what we spend on other things, a very tiny amount of money working on nuclear fusion, when if we had it, it would solve all our energy problems. It's safe, unlike nuclear fission reactors that use uranium and produce this radiation. It produces no greenhouse gases, so it would solve the problem of global warming. And it's using hydrogen, which we can get out of water as our fuel, so we'd have no more fuel problems. So to me, it's almost criminal that we spend so little time and effort trying to create nuclear fusion, given how much it would help us and the fact that we know, at least in principle, that it's possible.
You had just mentioned that you've written a number of science books for children. How are they received? And what angle do you take, Jeffrey?
Well, I have 5 books for children, and 4 of them take my dog Max on various adventures to the space station, the moon, Mars, and Jupiter. And one of them takes a little bit broader focus on the Earth and problems like global warming and nuclear fusion. I discuss in there also, and it's called The Wizard Who Saved the World. And as far as how they are received, I've gotten really good comments on them and feedback on them. And actually, the most exciting thing to me is they were recently selected to be the first children's books flown into orbit. And they were launched on January 9th, and all 5 of them are currently aboard the International Space Station, where they're being read by the astronauts, and those videos, once we get them, will be posted freely on the web for anyone to watch, along with other educational materials. And I really would like to ask all your listeners a big favor, which is to go to the Storytime from Space Facebook page and like us, because that will really help spread the word about this opportunity, which we hope will really be useful to teachers around the world.
Kids love space. They love science.
Kids love space. Yep. Space and dinosaurs, right?
Yep.
Kids love space because space, you can't escape it. Everyone wants to know, how do we fit in? And when you look up in the sky, you realize there's a lot more out there than there is right just here. And so you're naturally going to be interested. This is why humans have been interested throughout history in what's out there. And so kids love it. They're interested in the idea of traveling out there. So I've tried to write these children's books to inspire this next generation of kids, not only to think about how they might travel into space, but to think about how our human capabilities mean we can do better things for the world. We talked a little earlier about how I see us as this generation at the turning point, and I want to inspire these kids to do their part to make sure we turn in the right direction for the future and not in the wrong direction.
Jeffrey, if Isaac Newton had a chance to talk with Albert Einstein, what do you think those two would be talking about?
Well, first, Newton would thank Einstein for plugging that big hole in the theory of gravity that Newton himself had recognized. And then they'd be talking about all these new things that we've been hearing about in the news, the discovery of evidence for inflation and what it means, all the same things you and I have been talking about tonight, I think is what they'd be talking about.
Would there be any arguments there?
Oh, there's always arguments, right? But it would sure be interesting to hear, wouldn't it?
Oh, it sure would be. What is on the horizon? What's out there that they're dabbling in that would just be mind-boggling for us?
Well, I think the most mind-boggling thing would be definitive proof that everyone agrees on, showing that there is other life in the universe, and particularly if we got a signal from intelligence.
Oh, that would be great. Through SETI. And I understand Seth Shostak also wrote a little blip for you on the back of your book.
He did. He's been very kind to me like that. He's also my co-author on the Life in the Universe textbook that's used by college students for astrobiology course.
Super. I like him.
He's wonderful.
One day we may get that signal somehow.
Yep, Seth is betting on it coming fairly soon. I think it would be really, really cool if, you know, that would certainly be about as major a discovery as you could ever imagine in human history.
Jeffrey, Stephen Hawking says it's not a good idea to constantly send out information and things throughout space that would warn people that we're here, and he says that's kind of dangerous.
You know, it's interesting that he said that. I don't really agree with him on that point, because he was talking about sending out deliberate signals that someone might respond to. But in fact, you know, you can't help the fact that our radio communications are going out into space. Our television shows are going out into space. They've been doing that for many, many decades. So, you know, it's certainly, you can't completely rule out the idea that aliens would be mean and would want to come and take our world from us. But if they did, it's not going to be because we on purpose broadcast the hello. It's going to be something they saw on television that makes them come kill us, right?
Maybe.
But truthfully, I think that in order to travel among the stars, you have to have navigated through this turning point in history that we've been talking about, where you have the capability to destroy yourselves or to start moving out towards the stars. And therefore, I think any civilization that survives and starts to travel into space is going to have to have figured out a way not to destroy themselves. And that means to me that they've probably figured out a way to behave decently among others.
You would hope so.
Yep, I think so.
But you never know.
You never know for sure.
I mean, there's always the bad egg in the basket.
That's right. You can certainly imagine that. But again, the bad egg probably didn't survive, at least in terms of civilization.
That's a good point. Good point. We're going to take this quick break. Jeffrey, we're going to come back with a final hour with you, and we're going to take phone calls. And by the looks of things, the lines will all be full in minutes. I'm George Norrie. We will be back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Jeffrey Bennett, our guest. What is reality? You're next.